Say what I'm trying to say, clearer. She just compared, you know, the way she described it.
The title I gave you the other evening for tonight's presentation was an outline of Mesopotamian history to Neo-Babylonian times. We couldn't possibly even do a simple outline of it. And I'm going to hop, skip, and jump around, but I'll tell you on what basis we're doing it. A rough outline of the presentation tonight would be to call the first section of the survey 2334 BC to 750 BC, and then 750 to 625, and then 625 to 539. Now this last period, 625 to 539, is the period of the Neo-Babylonian dynasty, also known as the Chaldean dynasty, and sometimes it is put in parentheses. I mean in quotation marks. This includes the bulk of the 6th century BC, where my particular interest has been and remains, and where the focus of this short course is located. It may be tonight that we will not complete this outline, and that won't bother me too much because next Monday night we can concentrate on the final part of it. But if we get there tonight, that'll be handy also. Now the first thing I'd like you to do is to take the sheet that is dated October 19, 1983, that is titled Some Important Royal Names in Mesopotamian History. Now, these are by no means a complete list, but it is an important list, and I want to run through it with you just to give you an outline and also to call your attention to the reason for using the list. The reason for using this list is to give you an opportunity to see the names which kings in Mesopotamia had. Now, how did they get these names? Primarily in two ways. They received them at birth from some prominent person, perhaps in the family, or some official pronounced the name over them, or they took the name at the time when they became royalty. We call that second category throne names, names which people take when they become kings. Now you may remember in recent history, we come from various parts of the world, but in England, what's the full name of the new baby? Quite a long name. These are names that reflect family and tradition and identity and all of that. Now the interesting thing about these names and other names like them in the ancient Near East is the fact that most of them are sentences. Sentences with either a verb and a subject, and sometimes an object also, three-part name, and oftentimes two nouns, in which the relationship between the two nouns is an equation. Such as, Jane is a woman. That kind of sentence, which in Semitic ordinarily doesn't have a verb expressed, just express it by the putting the words next to each other in the proper order. Now, take a look at some of these names. Since the subject of our inquiry has to do with deities and humans and their relationships, it is an important part of the data that we have to deal with to look at the names, because most of the names have as their subject the name of a deity, in which, by which means the person, either as a child and just as a person, or as a king, has a name which calls attention to the relationship to a particular deity. Now let's look through this list quickly and identify some of them. And at the same time, run through this brief outline just to get the skeleton of the way in which Mesopotamian history developed. I told you these are not all the names. The way I chose the names was backward, because my inquiry is backward. I am aware of the fact that the Neo-Babylonians, the Chaldean dynasty, understood themselves and professed to be the inheritors, the conservators of the Babylonian tradition. And so I'm working backward from the kinds of names that characterize them back into earlier times to look for some of the earlier occurrences of names like that. That is the way this presentation tonight is organized. Anyway, it's backwards. It's an effort to go back and look at what things poured into, through the stream of tradition, what things poured into the Neo-Babylonian dynasty, which is the last of the native dynasties of Mesopotamia. Thereafter, Persian period, the Greek period, others ensued. Okay. Beginning with the Akkadian dynasty, this is the same designation as the designation of the language, and it's related to the city of Akkad or Agad, which was the capital of this dynasty. It is the time when some Semitic people, speaking a Semitic language and writing a Semitic language, one that is related to Arabic, related to Hebrew, Aramaic, and other Semitic languages, took over the southern part of Mesopotamia, took over the traditions and institutions of the Sumerian culture that preceded them. Remember that the Sumerians, who had introduced writing into this part of the world, had established cities, and I think it's correct that at the present time, even though we have thousands of pieces of writing from Mesopotamian times, from the Akkadians on, we have even more now available for the Sumerian period. But Sumerian, although it can be read now, translated, interpreted, is a language which doesn't belong in any of the known families of human languages that so far have been identified. Not my back there that we're following, that you may plumb one up, you're going to sit there. Okay? The founder of the Akkadian dynasty was Sargon the First. His name is later borne, as you notice down on the list, by a Sargon in the 8th century BC, who was king of Assyria. His name means the king is legitimate. And when you hear a name like that, you kind of say, well, why would anybody have to say that unless there was some question about it? But the next name is the one I want to call your attention to. Naram Sin. I'm pronouncing S-I-N as Sin in order to keep you from thinking of it as the word sin, which is not in style anymore for most of us. We think only other people do that. But Sin, one of the earliest of the god names that we can document when we are looking at royal names, and it refers to the moon god. And this name is a sentence in which the subject is the moon god. All right, this Akkadian dynasty at the beginning took over Sumerian traditions. There's an outline there. Cherie, if you want one, you don't have to follow it if you don't want it. They took over the Sumerian writing system and refined it and began to write their own language, which we call Akkadian, in this system of cuneiform signs that we talked about the other evening. The next dynasty is an Ur dynasty, named from its chief city of Ur down in southern Babylonia. Tonight we will look at an Ur Nammu Stele and look a little closely, more closely at it than we did the other night. But notice that in that dynasty there are three kings who have the moon god's name as part of their name. The next one is called the Isin dynasty. And you will notice that one of the kings in that dynasty had as the god name, in his full name, Ishtar. Who is Ishtar? Ishtar is the goddess par excellence of Babylon. She is to be understood to be Venus, the brightest star in the heavens, and one which moves in such a way that its relationships can be used to determine the relationships of the earth to other of the heavenly bodies. Also in that same dynasty, we have, again, Sin names, Ursin and Sin Magir. Now, the Larsa dynasty. The first name I've listed there is Nur Adad. And Adad is the name of the storm god, the god of lightning, rainstorms, a god who will figure prominently in the story as we go along in this course, a god who is presented rather ambivalently by these people, because the storm god was responsible both for that water without which you couldn't grow crops in most places, but also was the one who brought lightning and destruction and hail. And so there's some ambivalence about Adad. Then notice the rest of the names in that particular dynasty that I have listed are all names with the moon god's name seen in it, or Adad. Now, at this point, notice that the god names we have figuring in these royal names have to do with weather and heavenly bodies. Okay? Now, at that point, over on the right-hand side, in the northern tradition, because we, in the preceding, we've been focusing mostly on the south, you will notice if you look in at the names in the northern tradition, that the first two I've listed, Puzer-Ashur and Puzer-Ashur II, have in them as the god name element, Ashur, also the name of the city, Ashur. from which also we get Assyria, all related. If you just run your finger down the left-hand list and look for Asher names in the Babylonian list, you won't find any. They're all over on the right-hand side, related to northern kings. Asher is a god of might and power whose primary function is to enable kings to win victories. And he is represented, as we'll see when we look at some of the representations, as the sun disk with wings, sometimes in the center of it with an arrow, bow and arrow. All right, the first Babylonian dynasty will be important to our story, and tonight we will look at, again, the Hammurabi stele, which comes from that, which is part of that famous law code. Notice that in this Babylonian dynasty, 1894 to 1595, pretty long period of time, that the god names other than Hammurabi's name are moon god names again. Now the reason these are prominent here in this list is that one of the things that characterizes the Neo-Babylonian period toward which we are headed is the fact that Nabu-Nasser, Nabu-Colasa, Nebuchadnezzar, Nabonidus are all kings whose names bear the name of the moon god, the later form of that name, which is Nabu. Same god as Sin. Sin is the older name. And therefore, the question of how old the tradition of using the moon god's name in royal names is concerned is part of our focus. Across on the other side of the list, we have the earliest occurrence in this list that I've got for you, of Shamshi. She's Shamshi Adad there. Shemesh, Shamash, is the sun god. And here we have two god names, Shamshi and Adad, which is a sentence which in effect says, the sun god is the storm god. And this became a name used in Assyria for kings over a long period of time. He's but the first. There are many others. I think five altogether. Now, at that point in the story, there is a dark age, as it is called, which, as you know from the way in which we talk about the Dark Ages sometimes during the medieval period, all depends on who's describing it. But described from the standpoint of the domination of Mesopotamia by the Assyrian northern power or the Babylonian southern power, it was a Dark Age because the influences from outside, the Hittites and others, kept the native people from really exercising their own power and influence. Sealand dynasty, number one. You notice I don't list any kings there because of the lack of the kinds of names that we're interested in. And don't have dates either because there's something very fuzzy about the dates for that dynasty, except the designation, which refers to that most southern part of Babylonia that we looked at the other night, the swampy, lakey, watery part of reeds, and the area where the marsh Arabs are located today. Kassite dynasty was a dynasty which, though it was the rule of the area by foreigners, it was by a group of foreigners who took over, adopted, and sponsored the indigenous traditions. They themselves are very hard to sketch out because they adopted Babylonian names, but their influence can be traced if we were trying to trace it occasionally in some of the material we look at. Notice the names that they have. Among them, the first occurrence of Marduk. In Marduk Apla Idina, 1171 to 1159. What does that mean? Marduk has given the son, or has established the heir to the throne. Then we have Marduk Habit Aheshu. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the first occurrence of the designation of the moon god under the name Nabu. And his full name is Nabucodonosor, which translated means the god Nabu has helped, saved, supported the legitimate heir to the throne. Then we have more Marduk names, Nabu names, over on the right hand side, Asher names, and Shamash and Adad. Come down through another Sealand dynasty, the Bazi dynasty, and the Elamite dynasty. You may remember the Elamites were the people on the map right down in this corner, just above the Arabian Gulf to the east of southern Babylonia. Now, we're going to try to slow down now in our running through these. Beginning about 978, down to 626, just before the beginning of the Neo-Babylonian period proper, many people enlisting these kings will use the word that I've used here, mixed, because the localization, the locus of the rule of northern and southern Mesopotamia shifted back and forth Syria and Babylon. And I suppose mixed is the best way to describe it, because if you try to trace it out, you get mixed up in trying to figure out who's who. But you'll notice that I've skipped from 978, the beginning of that, down to 747 and mentioned King Nabunasar. You'll notice Nabunasar is over 120 years before 625 when he begins his reign. And to give you a little documentation for the fact that this period is a time of mixing, the Neo-Babylonians, when they presented their own story and talked about their dynasty, great regularity traced it back to Nabunasar, even though there's not a consistent line from him down to 625. Nabunasar is king during whose reign we are told that careful astronomical calculations began to be developed with great exactitude, and it seems as though it was at this time that the developing science of mathematics was carefully applied to and wedded to astronomical observations, with the result that they could begin to predict such things as eclipses and the rising of various and setting of the heavenly bodies. Underlining again that in this brief run-through of these names, we keep running into names for the prominent heavenly bodies as names of gods whose aegis was important to the kings of Babylon and Assyria. Merodach-Baladan. That spelling of his name is used even by Assyriologists because that's the way his name is translated in the Hebrew Old Testament into English. That spelling of his name has become standard, even though if you were to translate it from Akkadian into English, you would translate it Marduk, Akla, Idina, very much like the one we had above in 1171 and 1159. You notice he's Merodach-Baladan II. Points back to that, came back in the 1100s. Sargon, the second Sargon. Sennacherib, although it's, again, is another spelling that's conditioned by the way it was translated in English and Hebrew. Sennacherib is a Sin name, a moon god. Merodach-Baladan comes back again, and Sennacherib again. I'll go back and forth at this point. And you'll notice that Sennacherib occurs over on the right-hand side as king of Assyria as well. Because during this particular period, in order to make it difficult for people who study ancient history to get the story straight, a lot of these people, well, you get that feeling after a while, you know, they just did this, so they had trouble. They had dual monarchies in which these kings, let's use Sennacherib or Sargon, who, even though they were kings up in Assyria, called themselves the kings of Sumer and Akkad, and actually served as king in both Babylon and Assyria, and at other times put the crown prince down in Babylon to manage affairs for them while they attended things up in Assyria. If this isn't getting confusing, you're missing the point. Esarhaddon. Again, it's another name affected by biblical translation, and it's used by Assyriologists because it's familiar. But his name is actually Ashur, Ahe, Idina. Another Ashur name. I simply want you to know that it's an Ashur name.
Did you skip a couple? Did you have a purpose? Those dates.
I've skipped some dates in there, yeah.
These guys die. Every 4 years, my wife come out for me. Seriously, look at this. We're talking 5 and 6 and 7 years, like the president. Re-elected.
No, they weren't elected. Now, electing king is not completely unknown in the ancient period.
For instance, Marduk.
If we read the record straight, as it's known now, in Ebla, city in Syria, they did elect their king. They were elected for about 7 years, I think, at a time, by a kind of council that elected heaven. But that's not the way they got to be king. You inherited it or you won it. You took it away from somebody else, kept it as long as you could. And most of them died at the end of that time.
Yeah, that's my point. These reigns along here are fairly really short up here.
Now, I'm not I don't want to give you the impression that by the way in which I've arranged this, I'm trying to give you the full picture. It is selective, simply to call attention to the way in which God names figure in royal names and to enable you to see some of the lines that run through the tradition. So that when we begin to talk more specifically next Monday night about the Neo-Babylonian period and the names which people had and the deities who were prominent. You will be aware of the fact that these are not innovations. These are conservation of tradition, in case of revival of ancient tradition. Now you didn't know the question, did you? You didn't know that?
Yeah, I did. Oh. Is this the same, for instance, Merodach Baladan II?
Yes, he was on the throne twice. In between times, he got in trouble with the people up in Assyria who were the real powers at the time. And he had to run off down to Sealand for a while, regroup, and then he came back, and you notice he didn't last very long the second time around. Very important king, though, because he was a king representative of a trend which we'll pick up tonight and Monday night, of the fact that Chaldeans, and he was one, whose homeland is down in most southern Babylon, down in the lake and swamp district down in that area, formed one of the main bodies of resistance to Assyrian domination. I'm going to come to the Chaldeans in just a few minutes. Let me read you a statement by Leo Oppenheim, who was one of the leading Assyriologists in the world. Let's see if we can find it. He says that the Chaldeans, and keep in mind, the Neo-Babylonians are Chaldeans. We'll explain that in a few minutes. That their activity of resistance, which they led so successfully, and the liberation movement that they supported eventually culminated in the rise of the Chaldean dynasty. But just to back up on that one and say that while it's certainly not the beginning of their history, our first mention of Chaldeans is in 878 BC. Now, that brings us to Ashurbanipal. Notice he's in both lists, on both sides of the list, because he was another one of these people who had the dual king. Cuneiform texts, something in the neighborhood of 1,200 or more texts discovered back in 1853. Which really led to the opening up of the whole study of Mesopotamian history and civilization through the medium of its writings.
Excuse me,
Ashurbanipal. Next to the, just as well, right there.
Oh,
he's the library man. Gonna look at. I hope we're going to get to one of his reliefs. Now, one last statement about this mixed period. Primary interest of this course has to do with the Neo-Babylonian, has to do with the Chaldeans, their traditions, and particularly the way in which they portray the relationship between deities and humans and life. For the mixed period, most of what we know about Babel in the south comes to us from the records of the north. That's one of the things that word mixed refers to. so that when I say that we know the Chaldeans from 878 on, it's because in Assyrian annals at this period, the land of Chaldea is mentioned. The people of Chaldea are mentioned as causing trouble to the Assyrian king, of being put down and of offering tribute. And then we get some interesting lists, which are very helpful to us in studying the Chaldeans, because they tell us what kinds of tribute they paid. And that helps us understand what those people were doing for an occupation, aside from resisting Assyria and giving the king trouble. Now, when we come to the Neo-Babylonian dynasty, you'll notice that the Assyrian list quits with Ashur-uballit II, because Assyria was effectively put out of commission around 612 BC. Its long, powerful history as a dominant force in not only in Mesopotamia, but in the ancient Near East, reaching all the way to Asia Minor and to the borders of Egypt and into Egypt and to the east, was brought to an end very quickly by the combined efforts of the Medes and the Babylonians and assorted others. So that Nineveh was attacked in 614, besieged, was attacked and destroyed in 612. It's a very interesting thing happens at that point, though, that I think is important for our story, and that is that when Nineveh, the chief city, one of the chief cities of the Assyrians, was taken in 612, you'll notice that Ashur-uballit's reign didn't end. In fact, it just began. But where did he reign? Not in Assyria. He reigned in a city called Haran, up in Syria. Haran is a very interesting city from a number of points of view, but for our particular story, it's particularly important because it is one of the chief important cities for the worship of the moon god, Sin, or Sin. Haran. I'll show you on the map. Okay? It's the place from which Abraham is said to have come after going from Ur up to Haran and then into Mount Turkey. Is that in Turkey now? It's in Turkey.
Where's the crossing point?
Yeah. Right on here.
New David's starting next.
New
David's starting next.
Who is that?
Larry Snake.
Oh yeah, that's right, from the University of Chicago. Right on the border. Interesting. All right, the names in the Neo-Babylonian dynasty now. Look at the dominance in these names of Nabu names. And two others are Marduk names. Part of our story, as we look at the whole issue of deities and their relationships, is the fact that Nabonidus, the last of these kings, claims in the documents that relate to him to have been a servant of Marduk. But his name tells us that he had a relationship with the moon god. Na'id means pleasure. He is the one who pleases. He was opposed by the people in Babylon, his capital city, who worked at the Marduk temple, because they regarded him as doing things which might put or cut the influence of the Marduk worshippers and of Marduk himself, and as a sponsor of Nabu as the chief god. He never brought that off, or seems not to have. Now, one of the documents that I wanted to turn to next Monday or Wednesday, depending on how we progress, is a document about his mother. There's some uncertainty about her name. There does not seem to be much uncertainty about her role. And believe it or not, our best documents indicate to us that this lady lived from the time of Nabonassus to the ninth year of her son or grandson, Nabonidus. It is claimed that she lived 104 years. And she was, if you want to call her, priestess of the temple of the moon god in Haran, which Nabonidus rebuilt at great expense when he was king. And this is one of the things that engendered the opposition of the Marduk priests of Babylon to him, and led to the fact that in 539, when the foreigner, Cyrus the Mede, put an end to the Neo-Babylonian Empire, you'll see his name down there, 538 to 530. And when he came to Babylon, he was welcomed with open arms and took Babylon without a fight. One of the interesting things we're going to look at when we move along is the fact that Cyrus, for whatever reasons, whether serious ones or just politically convenient ones, claimed that he was brought to Babylon by Marduk to liberate. And he was welcomed as a liberator.
Who was Marduk?
Marduk. Marduk is the chief god of Babylon. What does it mean? What does it mean?
Does the name mean anything?
Yes, but I don't remember who it was. More important is his function. No, yeah. Shamash is his son. Marduk is the organizer of the universe. In the epic of creation, Marduk is the one who figures out a way to bring order out of disorder in the world. And he does it having talked to the other gods and goddesses ahead of time, due to the fact that if he does it, then they'll all give him preeminence. And at that point, when you read that story, that epic, you wonder which is the greater accomplishment, bringing order out of chaos or talking to the gods and goddesses into a deal like that ahead of time. Except that that underlines the importance of his role as the one who maintains order. If you look ahead at the list of titles, you will notice that the last presentation is a world ordered and reordered by the powerful deity, because one of the chief issues of the relationship between deities and humans and the world, as we see in Babylon, is who can maintain order. Did not say law and order. You might hear it that way, but I didn't say it that way. But that issue is very much there. And so one can say that Marduk is the organizer and maintainer of the orderly world that the Babylonians talked about.
So that's why you say that that Navinitis claimed to be, what you say, he was claiming to be the father of Marduke, but he had this moon guy somewhere in there.
Yeah, let me just read you some of that from one of the texts. Okay, this is Navinitis talking about his rise to power. I am a king who always, daily, and without interruption, is interested in the maintenance of the temples of Marduk and Nabu. I had plated with shining silver the wooden door leaves of all the rooms in the temple of the gods of the upper and lower world, the mystery room of Marduk and his consort, the door leaves of the temple. So, I am also a caretaker who brings large gifts to the great god. In the month of Nisan, the 10th day, when Marduk, the king of the god, as well as all the other gods from the upper and lower world were seated in the chapel of the offering, I brought in for them Ulysses' monumental amount of gift that he brings in. I went to Uruk, down south, Larsa, down south, Ur, and brought silver and gold and precious stones to Sin, Shamash, and Ishtar. And he talks about how he restored the cults, the worship systems and rituals and shrines of Marduk and the other chief gods. Notice that in response to your previous question, Marduk is also represented at that time and far back from the time he got his ascendancy, which we'll look at in a couple of weeks, as the king of the gods and as the one par excellence who established kingship and maintains kingship in human society for its welfare and protection. Now, take those two things and put them together, and the fact that we've been looking at royal names very quickly tonight in a kind of hurried overview to see what kind of people functioned in the history of Babylon and Syria. The king in the traditions that we're looking at was regarded as the human representative of the order that the gods had established for the welfare of humankind. And the kings regularly would call themselves the servant of whatever deity it is, and are the ones who are charged with the maintenance of the temples, the rituals, cults, and are responsible to the gods for the welfare of the people. When we come back again to look at Marduk and the way he is described and represented, we will say more about that.
there any relationship between Marco and Mala, Malaco County?
Okay, any questions at this point? We've got just a couple minutes left. Can we have you look at the slides here? That way we won't have to move the machine. Yeah, we're gonna leave it. We got it all set up so we can use it. I didn't use it. Any other question?
Did you say Sargon meant the king in flesh? Meaning of Sar.
Sargon, it's actually our way of spelling two words, Sharu Kenu. Sharu King, Kenu, legitimate, authentic. It means king is legitimate. It's a claim to legitimacy.
So they say Sharu Kenu.
Sharu Kenu is the way it would be in Akkadian. But see, many of these names were first known through the Bible, before they were known in Akkadian, and the spellings that were developed in English and other translations from Hebrew led to some of these rather strange spellings that we have. But they're kept because they're familiar.
You should just read and just say that Nebuchadnezzar went down south and brought back gold and silver to it. I thought you said sin.
Mm-hmm. Sin and Shamash and Ishtar.
Now, what are those?
Sin is the moon god, also Nabu.
So they're using the two names, moon god, synonymous at the same time?
Yes. One is the older name.
Yes, I understand.
Sumerian.
But it wasn't thrown away with. He used it.
And Nabu is the Semitic name. Okay. And there's another one. It's again another name, Nana. It sounds like grandmother to me, but
Mint.
Yeah. Oh well.
So they were using the old and new names.
Yes.
It wasn't. The name had not expired.
No. No, because one of the things that's true of all of this that we're talking about is that the mainline traditions with which we have become familiar through the documentation available the last 100 years, have introduced us to a very conservative tradition that at one and the same time deals with the present and preserves the very, very, very ancient past and brings that material into the present as though it belonged there and originated there, at the same time reaching back to its great ancestors. It's a very impressive accomplishment to have preserved these things. For instance, in the Akkadian dynasty that you mentioned first, they took over these old Sumerian traditions. In the Hammurabi dynasty, the Babylonian dynasty number one there, 1894 or 1595, whatever that is, that's when a great deal of literary activity went on in standardizing these ancient texts and producing the materials that scribes would need for copying and interpreting them through the years, like dictionaries that we mentioned the other night and other resources like that. So that there was a standardization period during the first Babylonian dynasty, and many of these things did not change measurably through this long period of time except as they were applied to specific situations are brought into flow from time to time. One of the things that Ashurbanipal did, and I'm not sure, you know, whether it would have been surprised to him that he did it or not, but when he collected this great library and brought these documents into Nineveh, up in the north, from all over the realm, he may have set off some of the very forces which led to the rise of the Chaldeans and the Neo-Babylonians because of their own identification with the bulk of that tradition. Many people in describing the history of Babylonia and Assyria keep referring to Babylon, the city and the area, as the center of the cultural tradition of Mesopotamia, and find in the Assyrian claims to relationship with Babylon a recognition of the fact that that's where it really was, and that one had to make peace with that tradition in order to be regarded as legitimate. They're good lemon cookies, but no, he didn't.
And he now he seems to show up after the Kassite dynasty.
Nabu?
Yes, Nabu. According to his disciple,
yes.
Right. Nabu seems to show up.
That's right.
Kassite dynasty. I was wondering if it's a Kassite influence or is it still a Canaan?
It's Canaan.
I'm going to come on. Okay. Oh, that's not so good.